What is government for? What turns me off about libertarianism? What turns some men on about lesbianism? And a poetic response on this, the 19th episode of Last Impressions. I'm Justin Katz. Will somebody please tell me why the Providence Journal thinks it can get away with simply asserting over and over again that the Medicaid reform in a House GOP legislation to repeal Obamacare is going to eliminate, take Medicaid away from people who currently have it. It's not. That's just not true. The people who currently have it, their future people like them may not get it if the state chooses not to give it to them because the state's going to have to pay a little more than the federal government. But anybody on it right now keeps it. And the Providence Journal just keeps repeating that. It's unbelievable. The amount of spin and just outright anything anti-Trump right now is no holds barred. The media especially is just beyond the ability to regain its credibility, I think. It's unbelievable. I mean, you've got Sheldon Whitehouse, our senator from Rhode Island in the U.S. Senate, calling withdrawing from the Paris Accords a betrayal. Conveniently, that's an echo of a statement a few days earlier of Democrat mega donor Tom Steyer. But a betrayal of the country? How is he not being called on this? And then you turn to anything else, going back to healthcare, the Wall Street Journal had a good editorial a couple weeks ago, how the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, defined losing your insurance as people who would choose not to purchase the full insurance that the federal government has decided is the definition of full insurance. Well, duh, that's the point. How are they getting away with this kind of reporting, this aggressiveness? And you know that one, in fact, was the origin behind the famous Montana body slamming. So you know that shows you where we're going with that. Also this week on Newsmaker, Speaker on WPRI, Channel 12, Speaker Nicholas Mattiello, a Democrat from Cranston in Rhode Island, said he unveiled some of the details on his plan to eliminate the car tax in Rhode Island. And at the end of the phase out of the car tax, he wants to, and I think this might be an existing law, but he wants to link that money to the sales tax instead of the car tax. So cities and towns won't see that gradual organic increase in their car tax, he wants them to get a piece of the organic gradual increase of the sales tax. This is a terrible, terrible idea. If you model sales tax against car tax, the sales tax is much more efficient at creating economic, cutting the sales tax is much more efficient at creating economic opportunity and jobs. So in effect, if you substitute car taxes for sales taxes for car taxes, you are killing jobs. Is that what we need in Rhode Island? Also in that interview, Speaker Mattiello was talking about the Paw Sox, and when either Ted Nesi or Tim White, the reporters who host that show, one of them asked, well, you were all for moving the Paw Sox to Providence and some kind of deal on that. And his response, Speaker Mattiello's response was, oh, well, I had a gut feeling that was a good deal. I'm just not seeing the evidence in Pawtucket, and I don't have a gut feeling. A gut feeling? Really? Is that how we run our business? Is this how millions and tens and scores of millions of dollars are spent in Rhode Island because of a gut feeling of a couple powerful people that it's a good idea? No study, no nothing, just, I have a gut feeling. Let's force it through. Luckily, he was stopped there, but the Paw Sox are still going. And on a similar note, you've heard probably about Frank Montanaro Jr., who's currently a higher-up, appointed official in the JCLS, the Joint Commission Committee on Legislative Services in the General Assembly in Rhode Island. He apparently 3 years ago left an $83,000 job with the Rhode Island College and to take up this job, which I guess last year he was paid $155,000. So that's a $72,000 raise he took. But because of his contract, he was allowed to ask Rick, and Rick granted him the ability to stay sort of to treat it as a trial period so that after over 3 years, he could try out this new job in the General Assembly. And if it didn't work out, he could go back. His job was guaranteed in the Rhode Island College. Now, that's outrageous enough. But if you add to that this nugget that also Ted Nesi and Tim White discovered, he's been getting free tuition because he's technically an employee. A free tuition for a guy who doesn't work there, who took a $72,000 raise to go to a different wing of state government, and he's used that to the tune of $50,000 of free tuition, partly for his son and partly for somebody who he's calling, quote, a guardian. What does that even mean? I wrote about this today on the Ocean State Current. This is racketeering. This is using collective bargaining and gaming the political system to just take people's money and give it to powerful families. It's unbelievable. How are people not rising up and just saying, you know what, if that, the excuse is, oh, it's in my contract. Well, if that's in the contracts have to be ripped up. If the politicians won't rip up the contracts, they need to go. Wow, when are Rhode Islanders really going to wake up to this? Well, we know the answer to that, right? Don't we? What's really happening, as the Rhode Island Center for Freedom has been saying, with 11, showing that 11 communities worth of people have left Rhode Island for other states on a net basis. The people who would fight back are just leaving. They're seeing, you know what, we had the mob and now we've got state government doing the same kind of things. And they're in gambling and they're going to probably be in pot sooner than we think. And that's just where we're going. So a lot of people leave. But can we at least muster some revolutionary angst and anger and at least get some consensus around that? Well, as my rant showed, I have a very, very heavy libertarian leanings. But the biggest topic I wanted to discuss today was that there's something about the views of those who label themselves as libertarians that's been really lately just pushing me away. I remember when I was in college, one of my professors, I was still pretty naive politically, and one of my professors said, marked me out as a libertarian, and I asked what it was, and he said, you know, there are people who don't think there should be any government, you know, even like streetlights and stuff, which I don't think that's quite there, but that was, at the time, I said, yeah, sign me up for that. But lately, I'm not able to get to that kind of a feeling anymore. And on this week's Econ Talk, or last week's Econ Talk with Rush Roberts from the Hoover Institution, which, by the way, this isn't going to become a weekly response to Econ Talk, unless it's merited, in which case I guess that's fine. But he was, as an Econ Talk episode, he released the audio from a panel he did at a Cato Institute event. And his panelists were David Boas, but I might be mispronouncing that, who's the vice president of Cato, P.J. O'Rourke, who's a well-known libertarian-ish writer, known to, you know, have a lot of humor, and then George Will, who's a conservative columnist for the Washington Post. And what really started to put this particular thought about libertarianism's turnoff for me into focus was at the beginning when Boas started out the sort of introductory comments from each of them. Roberts asked them how they see the state of sort of liberty in the United States right now. And Boas said he's bullish. He says he's optimistic because in the long term, and this I agree with, liberty works and socialism doesn't. So you'll get these tides back and forth. Eventually, though, as we accumulate knowledge and so on and advance, will move toward liberty, is his view. And in the short term, he said he's optimistic because we're on the upswing. He said we've gotten rid of a lot of the worst parts of the New Deal. Tax rates are changed significantly over the past, say, 30, 40 years. But also, and I suspect this was his emphasis, as a matter of personal liberty, where we've seen a lot of positive changes, by which he means things like same-sex marriage. And that's what made my ears perk up a bit and made the light bulb go off. Because, you know, what's happened is the liberals have been using those sorts of personal liberties to get at more fundamental freedoms. And that's something I don't think libertarians appreciate sufficiently if they're sincere in their libertarianism. And to really drive the point home, just a few minutes after Boas made that statement, Roberts moved on to P.J. O'Rourke, he moved on P.J. O'Rourke and then to George Will. And George Will made this comment, which really stuck in my mind.
We see on American campuses, and we know that what happens on campus doesn't stay on campus. We see on campus a rising generation of extremely badly parented young people who really do not like the First Amendment. And when it goes, everything goes.
So what's striking there is that right after you have David Bowes, and I just checked the pronunciation. I apologize for mispronouncing his name at first. He's saying liberty is on the upswing, and you see this a lot with young people in college and such who insist on these liberal social positions. But then you get George Will saying, well, you know what? These young kids, they don't like the First Amendment. And that's where, you know, that connects the wires and makes the charge go off. For a lot, in that sense, libertarianism has been a sort of a pose, not with these guys, obviously, not with people who are self-consciously libertarians, but in the culture. And libertarianism as a principle, liberty, freedom, has been co-opted, civil rights, co-opted in the name of liberalism, and is now being leveraged to get at basic, fundamental freedoms. I mean, same-sex marriage to me is the case in point, and I think that's where I started to really get this sense from libertarianism. They use the courts, and government by other means, but mainly the courts, to redefine a cultural institution called marriage, against the will of probably a majority of people, although increasingly quiet about it. And now they're going after apostates. And we saw this with what's his name, the guy who founded Mozilla. They went after anybody who funded or helped to pay for campaigns to maintain a traditional definition of marriage. And then the news media went out when marriage started to become redefinition of marriage started to become forced on to people. The news media went out to backwoods small towns to find Memories Pizza, where in a completely hypothetical situation, somebody who worked at the pizza joint said, yeah, I guess we wouldn't cater a same-sex marriage. And the media went after them, and they received threats. That's not liberty in my book. So this idea that it's okay to get these big social changes on a short time frame through the use of government force, really, I guess it fosters this mentality that government is supposed to be the tool for everything. That government is where you go to force people to change their minds and do things you want them to do. And that, in my book, should be much, much worse for somebody who sincerely holds libertarian views than, you know, the good feeling of getting your way on an issue, especially as a social liberal on something like marriage. I mean, especially in this day and age. I mean, I made this point often during the same-sex marriage debate. Gay people, on average, do well, even better than the average, on a whole host of indicators, wealth, levels of education, that sort of thing. So, you know, maintaining the traditional definition of marriage wasn't exactly the linchpin for holding them down. And I was disappointed later in the econ talk because it seemed like they were almost getting there to some degree. And P.J. O'Rourke in particular, it's like he walked right by this glaring problem. You know, take a listen.
I would personally like to see more outreach on campus. I think that AEI seems to be doing a really good job on that. I would like to see a sort of Cato the Younger out there, because we have the kids' full attention on certain libertarian issues. They are very libertarian in the sense that you were talking about how the glass is half full. You know, they despise any of the kind of oppressions that the historical oppressions that America, that you could fault America for, but they don't sort of realize the connection between that and economic liberty and indeed personal responsibility.
So he's saying that that young adults in America don't get the connection of social liberties to economic liberties. And what I think he's just completely missing here is that he says certain oppressions, they despise certain oppressions, but that's particular political points of view that he may share, but they're liberal points of view. And it's not clear to me for sure that they are objectively the hallmarks of liberty, whereas things like maintaining a definition, being able to call marriage one thing and not another, is fundamental to more basic liberties, civic rights, able to define your society in some regards, in some level, somewhere, and to call a distinction where you see one. So liberals and maybe liberal libertarians want to erase the distinction between same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples, but that's not an objectively, biologically, that's, I would say, ludicrous. They're doing that by redefining what marriage is and what its purpose is, and then using the law to force that on other people. Now, the reason kids today get it from the libertarian's point of view on social liberties and not on economic liberties is because they've been trained to think, I think, that the former are contrary to the latter. That to think that and that, that government is the mechanism for dispensing benefits and liberties. So what do I mean by they think that social liberties are contrary to economic liberties? Well, libertarians see social liberties as almost a subset of economic liberties. They both derive basically from property rights. So the socially liberal policies would be an acknowledgement of your possession of yourself. People can't tell you what to do with yourself or your identity. But in accepting progressives' bargain to push those liberal social views through government, libertarians have contributed to the notion that things like same-sex marriage aren't so much an expression of personal liberty. They're not somebody saying, this is who I choose to be and who I am, and it's my liberty to say that and behave accordingly. What they're doing is they're making that particular policy notion, that social notion, the definition of personal liberty. That is, personal liberty becomes another way of saying policies that liberals like. It's not an objective definition. It's just, this is what we like, and that's what a personal liberty is. So for a good contrast here, to illustrate the point, I posted this week on a farm in Michigan owned by a Catholic family, and they have opted and noted this on their Facebook page that their farm property is available for traditional marriages, ceremonies on the property, but not same-sex marriage ones. And so the city of East Lansing, Michigan, which hosts, I guess, some kind of public farmers market, set up a policy and said, well, you know what, if that's your policy, if those are your beliefs, you're not welcome at our farmers market, which has on our property, which has nothing to do with your farms and what you do with your property. It's just you come here to sell your stuff. So the city of East Lansing has blocked these Catholic farmers. That's clearly an undermining personal liberty. But these kids on college campuses and liberals and too many libertarians don't see it that way because they seem to believe that the Catholic view, the traditional view, isn't an expression of sincerely held beliefs identifying a person and part of their right to define their society, but rather as certain historical oppressions for which you can blame the United States. So they've put it in a category. There's no higher principle there. So, you know, liberals like same-sex marriage. So that's an expression of personal liberty. But they don't like Catholic farmers and their use of their own property to promote their beliefs. So that's not a personal liberty. And, you know, in this case, the farm even says they'll refer people to other properties that might suit them if they don't if the farm is farm owners aren't a match for the prospective clients. This is not an institutional oppression. This is just here's our property. We're going to use it as should be our right to further our beliefs in some small way. Now, of course, customers in hearing of this policy can choose not to buy produce from this farm or to tell people not to host weddings there, or not attend weddings there. But the idea that this is like a historical oppression is backwards, completely backwards. And that's why I think it was the same-sex marriage issue that really turned me off of libertarianism, you know, as an ism. Basically, I don't believe it's partisans anymore. In Rhode Island, there were a couple Republicans who just their and conservative Democrats for that matter, who just their posturing on passing same-sex marriage and they're gloating and virtue signaling really fell in the face, I thought, to the idea you just used government to redefine marriage. And you're going to tell me you're the small government libertarian? I can't swallow that. And I just don't believe it. They've got their thumb on the scale just as much as anybody else. And you know, that's what started to become clearer and clearer to me after that moment was that, you know, that's dangerous. When your ideology is susceptible to and has some believers who go to extremes with this, not just, you know, fringe people, but actual spokespeople for libertarianism who insist that we have no moral obligation to help each other and take property rights to that level. You're really getting into dangerous territory when you also put your finger on the scale, the social scale, because you're saying, you know, you don't have any right to make us be good people, but we're going to use government to stop you from working together to foster a society that you think produces good people. So speaking of things that turn people on or off, a terrible segue, I know. I just wanted to touch on in this podcast, because I think if I put it in print, I'd probably get in trouble. But the New York Post had an article, I guess some guy, some scientist of some kind, did a study. I don't have details of the study because it seems kind of silly to me, but he asked a bunch of guys whether they found lesbianism attractive, and based on the numbers who said yes, he hypothesized that lesbianism evolved because it attracted men, and so women with that attraction would naturally get more men, and then therefore reproduce more, and that's how you would get evolution. Now, I think there's a whole lot wrong with that. I didn't go in and read the entire study, so it may be more nuanced than that summary gives it credit for. But what's interesting was the instant attacks that this guy got. Just people, how could you say that? You know, how could you even put that idea forward? Of course, men make it all about men, and you know, lesbians wrote to the guy and said, you know, if my attraction it belies your entire thesis. And you know, what occurred to me was, you know, rather than fall back on anti-scientific ranting, why not respond in an intellectual way? I mean, for one thing, modern lesbians may profess no attraction to men, but that's doesn't really make a difference. I mean, humanity used to prioritize procreation much more highly versus sexual relationships. You know, you hear of the ancient Greeks who may have been attracted to other men, but they felt a responsibility to have children and have a domestic life in that way. And not only that, but in a male-dominated society, which it was much more in the past, male attraction to lesbians would have resulted in more procreative sex with lesbians, even if the lesbians didn't like it. I mean, you can't have it. You can't, you know, take the fruits of egalitarian equality between men and women and not acknowledge, you can't say there's a patriarchy and not acknowledge the consequences of it in the past. But, you know, part of what I think what they're missing here is if you take an intellectual approach to this stuff, you know, other possibilities come up too. I mean, for one thing, I sometimes wonder whether we're behind a cultural curtain. I mean, if you look at historical art, something like Beggar's Opera, for example, or even classic poems, was it The Miller's Wife or something like that? We've been raised to believe that women incline more toward chasteness and monogamy. But, you know, maybe that's an artifact of cultural mores from the last century, not so much a biological fact. So who knows? This male attraction to lesbians may have originated to the extent that it's genetic and evolutionary. Maybe it originated with women. You know, men who wanted to have children, maybe they had to be okay with lesbianism. Or you could see it, especially in situations where, say, the dominant man of a community had multiple wives. I mean, those in the harem might have sought out other ways to gratify themselves. And if that attracted the man, then that would have resulted in the natural selection that the scientist is talking about. And, you know, of course, individual men being attracted to multiple partners obviously increases their odds of multiplying, which, so, you know, the idea that this should be a controversy is just bizarre. But, you know, whatever the case, I'd say it's clearly the argument, especially, is a carryover from an unhealthy past. And, you know, whatever the evolution of our sins, we're called to transcend that, to take control. That's the whole purpose of choice, of free will and choice and freedom and liberty, is to transcend, to pick a better future and not be slaves to our past and what may have forces that may have pushed us to where we are right now. Speaking of slavery, Jay Nordlinger, for his Q&A podcast on Ricochet, had a guest who was J. Mills Thornton. He's a historian of American history, particularly the South and the Civil War. And just incidentally, Mills quoted, I guess he used to end his class with this, he quoted from the poem Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. And it really struck me, and I read the poem, and upon reading it, instantly I had to respond. So my lighter note ending this week is going to be on that. So first let me read real quick Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. This is written around 1851-ish. The sea is calm tonight, the tide is full, the moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast, out in a tranquil bay. Come to the window, sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray, where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return upon the high strand. Begin and cease, and then again begin, with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in that sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I hear only its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. That's kind of a dark sentiment there. So I couldn't help but write this today, and I call it Responding to Matthew Arnold, Tide Still Going Out. What if the tide is going out? So what? It ebbs and flows and comes and goes, and shows then only girdle, but soon only gut. And that soft skin the tide of cloth exposed, should I see it as vulgar truth displayed, or as my loved one bare from nose to toes? Matthew, a younger man than I, though staid, when he wrote the Dover's retiring din, mistook mere hours' light for life useless grade. Young sir, my elder, there's beauty going out as coming in. The tide's a tiff, each sally to rebut. The end o'erwhelms where you or I begin. And I'll put the text on that up in a post, I guess. And that's it for this week. I'll talk to you next week.